Hi, I'm Mike Collins. We'll get to the Charlotte Talks podcast in just a moment. First, I want to tell you about a special public conversation I'm hosting, and you're invited to join me and several of Charlotte's African-American leaders for Building an Inclusive City. That's on February 21st, 7 p.m. at Spirit Square. We'll be talking with Charlotte's mayor, police chief, city manager, and district attorney. Details and free registration at WFAE.org, and we hope to see you there. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was 25 years ago this month, on February 28, 1993, that federal agents attempted to raid a ranch in Waco, Texas, belonging to the Branch Davidian religious sect. The group was suspected of weapons violations, and after an aborted attempt to confront them, the government arrived with massive force. A shootout ensued, resulting in the biggest gun battle in U.S. law enforcement history and the biggest such battle since the Civil War. What followed was a siege involving federal and Texas state law enforcement, as well as the U.S. military, in a standoff lasting 51 days until April 19, 1993. Though details of what happened that day remain a little cloudy, here is what it sounded like as cameras looked on and a national television audience watched through the day.
Dan Rather in New York and Vicki Mabry in near Waco with an update on the 51-day standoff outside Waco, Texas. Early this morning, armored vehicles entered cult leader David Koresh's compound and began punching large holes in the wall.
Some 6 hours after the FBI launched an operation trying to bring the 51-day-old standoff at the Branch Davidian cult compound just outside Waco, Texas, to an end, the compound has been enveloped in smoke and flame.
What followed was a whirlwind of controversy over who started that fire, over whether law enforcement went too far, and whether anything was worth the deaths of David Koresh, 74 of his followers, including some children, and of four federal agents. On this anniversary, many media outlets are re-examining the events of those 51 days with specials on two networks and on another, a six-part dramatic series with an all-star cast. UNC Charlotte's Dr. James Tabor wrote a book about the Waco incident, Why Waco, Cults, and the Battle for Religious Freedom in America. Tabor is a religious studies professor who testified before Congress and met with then-Attorney General Janet Reno and the FBI about that day. Dr. Tabor, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here, Mike.
Also with us is Gary Nestner, a former FBI negotiator, in fact, the chief of FBI crisis negotiation, of the FBI crisis negotiation unit, who worked on the Waco ordeal for 26 of the 51 days. He's the author of Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, and he joins us by phone from the Florida Keys. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Good to be here, Mike.
And we're joined by David Thibodeau as well, one of only nine Branch Davidians to survive the Waco siege and one of four survivors to not be sentenced to prison. He's the author of Waco, A Survivor Story, and served as an advisor for the Paramount Network six-part television series that began in late January and continues this month. David Thibodeau, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me on this morning.
I should point out that you too, Gary Nestner, your book is also forms the foundation of this TV series, this six-part miniseries on the Paramount Network. The two of your books were the foundation for that. Dr. Tabor, during the siege in 1993, you were involved with others in trying to work out an exit plan for David Koresh and his followers. How did your involvement in this come to be? Why were you involved at all?
Well, I am in Charlotte the whole time. I never went down there. But I worked with Dr. Phil Arnold, a colleague, and we got involved. We saw it, like everybody else, on February 28th on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw the raid. And actually, my wife called me to the TV and said, there's this crazy guy in Texas quoting the Bible. You ought to come and listen. And my specialty is apocalypticism in the ancient world, as you know, studying Jesus and his movement and mm-hmm. books like the Book of Revelation. So I know the language and I know the text really well. But on March 2nd, that was 2 days after the raid, David had worked out that if he gave a 1 hour, it's 58-minute rambling exposition of his message, that he would come out. And he later went back on that and said God had told him to wait. But I got a copy of that transcript. And I realized that part of the problem here was just communication. I could read that, even though he was wounded and groaning and rambling and interrupting himself. But I could understand it pretty well. I could get the parameters of
because
the
it was based on apocalyptic.
Exactly.
Disbelief. Okay.
And also the transcript was bad. For example, he talked about the lion of the tribe of Judah, and it came out in the transcript, the liar of the trial of Judas.
Okay.
Well, I wouldn't understand the liar of the trial of right. Judas, but so it was that sort of thing. And so then Arnold began attending the FBI press conferences. They were daily, went to Waco, and he and I were talking all the time. And then we started talking to Livingston Fagan, who was in at the time of the raid, and David sent him out to actually be a kind of theological spokesman. He's in jail, you understand. And so we would call him almost every day, and he would say, oh, you boys ready for your Bible study? So he literally tutored us in a crash course over 5 days in the Branch Davidian theology or their outlook.
You never spoke then directly to David?
Not directly. No.
You say that over the years you've been involved with a number of interviews and documentaries, most of which you say you found disappointing because they took the approach of examining, quote, evil, crazy cult leader David Koresh as he orchestrates the suicidal deaths of his fanatical, brainwashed followers. And you say all of that, what I just said, is all sadly incorrect. So how do you see him in the incidents that led up to 1993?
Well, David Koresh himself certainly had his bizarre aspects in terms of both his behavior and his teaching. But as far as a religious community, not a cult compound, but a believing religious community of people who were not brainwashed, were intelligent. One of them is a Harvard-educated lawyer. Steve Snyder was a professor at a university. Livingston Fagan had an MA. It's not saying everybody was that educated, but many of them were. They were there, and Thibodeau can tell you his own experience, right, because they had come to believe in David's biblical teaching. And so that's what I wanted to help the FBI to see and to understand, and I think we were somewhat successful in that.
So by helping the FBI understand where David Koresh was coming from religiously, biblically, in terms of his belief and the followers' belief, you thought that we could diffuse this situation a little bit and not come to what it came to?
Yeah, it's like world translation of what is their view. Because if he's seen as a false messiah, con man, cult leader, manipulator, then you would deal with him one way. And maybe it would be a hostage barricade situation, that he's barricading his followers that are under his mesmerizing control.
Yeah.
But if it's a believing community that takes the Lord's Supper twice a day, that prays, that thinks that he is the living prophet, then you've got to deal with them differently. And pressure, actually, in a sort of an apocalyptic atmosphere that the initial raid created, is the opposite of what you really want to do. Now, a lot of the negotiators knew that and were saying, let's tone this down and talk. And so that was essentially the approach we had. But we did finally get our message into David. Arnold and I made a tape, a radio program. The FBI let Dick DeGaron, of course, his lawyer, take it in, and he heard it. And Thibodeau was there. He can tell you about listening to it. But it totally transformed the situation in terms of David saying, okay, if we go with this, this can be over.
A lot of our listeners may not have been alive.
That's right.
In 1993. So let's go back to the 80s and 90s, Gary Noesner, because for those who don't remember, that was a time when there were law enforcement clashes with survivalist groups and anti-government extremists and militia, as well as a few religious cults along the way. Ruby Ridge immediately predated what happened in Waco, Texas. Did the government, did the media incorrectly tie all these events and all these groups together? Did this ongoing stream of groups cause the threat level to be artificially raised or amplified?
It's a difficult question to answer, and I'm not sure. I suspect so. I think, again, we've had mostly right-wing militia encounters, but we'd also had the Cross the Sword and the Arm of the Lord, a sort of a religious inspired militant group in Arkansas, and that had been successfully resolved. So the government had some experience in doing this, and I don't know if David or the doctor will agree or not, but to me, the mistakes at Waco were primarily a byproduct of the FBI not doing it the way we had done it 4 years before and did it successfully afterwards. So it was sort of a departure of our of the appropriate use of our knowledge and skills.
We're going to talk about what happened on that day in a minute or two, but David Thibodeau, you were there. You were inside the compound. You were a Branch Davidian, although you say you never considered yourself as a Branch Davidian. Is that not what members of that sect called themselves?
No, we didn't, actually. I think maybe some of the old-timers, the people that were there long, long before me, because they did branch off from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, become the Branch Davidians. But, you know, I had only been there a couple of years prior to all the events taking place. You know, I played drums with David, you know, in the band. And, of course, I was a part of the community, but we never called ourselves Branch Davidians. We didn't really have a title. We were a group of people there studying the scripture. So when the phrase, you know, when I first heard Branch Davidian, it was during the siege, when I realized that that's what the press was calling us.
Wasn't there a sign out front, or am I imagining this, that said something about Branch Davidians on the sign? I could be wrong. You were there.
I think later there might have been.
You were there, David.
Yeah, I was on the property later.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were there through the siege. What has the media, what did the government get wrong about the group, about David Koresh, about how the group was trying to live their lives and how they approached this showdown with law enforcement? What did they get wrong?
Well, I mean, you know, David was very approachable. He was very easy to talk to as a person. If there was ever a question of legality, he would call the sheriff, Jack Harwell. There was a period of time when the ATF were looking into a licensed firearms dealer that David knew very well, and they were raiding him, and they're asking him questions about all the yellow sheets on the firearms that he had sold to David. And David, through Henry McMahon, the firearms dealer, had invited the ATF out onto the property to check any of the firearms, any of the yellow sheets that they had in question. So he was very open to working with people. And it's just the fact that he was always shut down. They wanted a dynamic entry. This whole thing could have been avoided had the government chose to communicate with David, I believe.
This thing started, correct me if I'm wrong, but the FBI tried to go in, I think the day before or a couple of days before, and they saw...
I think it's important here, Mike. Mike, if I can interrupt you, it's very important to make the distinction here. The original raid was totally ATF. The FBI was not involved, was not knowledgeable about that. We were only called in after the shootout, jurisdictionally based on the fact that federal agents had been killed. So that's the only thing that brought the FBI into this.
Okay, so the ATF was going to go in a day or two before, and something happened. They decided to abort it. And then when they did go in, they went in with full force. Evidently, was this triggered by, a UPS guy who delivered packages to the compound, and one of the packages opened and out rolled a grenade, and he told somebody about that? Is that what happened there?
Well,
is this
for
the
me?
Story.
Gary, go ahead.
Gary, I mean, that's the story. That's what's been reported, that a UPS driver delivering some boxes noticed a grenade shell come out of the box. Mm-hmm. But I think there had been other information that ATF had been provided about suspicion of illegal conversion of weaponry. And, you know, I think that was just one of several pieces that they used to formulate the decision to conduct the raid.
There were a lot of weapons there. At least that's the allegation, and that's the reason they went in. And I want to talk to David when we come back from the break about why David felt there had to be so many weapons. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Waco, Texas, and what happened at the Branch Davidian compound. between February 28th, 1993, 25 years ago this month, and April 19th, 1993, a 51-day siege ensued with the government and the Branch Davidians. David Thibodeau was a member of that sect and was inside the compound for an entire period of time. He's written a book called Waco, A Survivor's Story, and was an advisor on a six-part mini-series on the Paramount Network, which started in late January and continues this month, along with Gary Nestner, who's a former chief of the FBI Crisis Negotiation Unit and was there for the first 26 of the 51 days of that siege, trying to negotiate a settlement. He's also written a book about this, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And Dr. James Tabor is here, professor of religious studies at UNC Charlotte, author of Why Waco, Cults and the Battle for Religious Freedom in America. We often hear the word cult with regard to the Branch Davidians. Dr. Tabor, were they a cult or just a sect?
Yeah, in the Academy of Religion, mm-hmm. we avoid the word cult, and we've been meeting with the FBI now for 25 years talking about this. I think a lot of improvement has been made. The problem with cult, it's sort of like the N-word in terms of racism. It's a label you slap on somebody. One person's cult is another person's dearly held faith. Baptists were considered cult leaders in colonies of America early on by the Episcopal Church. Jesus was considered a cult leader. If you have high demand religion, leave everything, follow me, I'm the one, I speak for God. And so it's better just to describe the group than to give them this label, because it brings in a whole set of connotations. They saw themselves, as David said, as students of the Bible, not as a cult, and even calling it a compound, which everybody does. They would call it their home. It was called the Mount Carmel Center, so a Bible study center where people take the Lord's Supper twice a day, pray and study, and live according to their
beliefs. But for those who don't remember it, that place was enormous. It had a gymnasium. It had sleeping quarters for men and women. It had a swimming pool out back. I mean, it was enormous.
But not luxurious, believe me. That sounds like a villa, right. But actually it was pretty handmade.
So as I understand it, David Thibodeau, you met David Koresh at the Guitar Center, because you were a musician. Were you religious prior to meeting with David? What was the attraction? What made you go and join them? Oh, I'm sorry, David. Start again. I had you off. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I said, yeah. Well, Mount Carmel definitely wasn't luxurious. Thanks, James, for throwing that in there. I met David in Sunset Boulevard at Guitar Center. It was Dave and Steve. They were looking at one of the drum sets, electronic kits. And they asked me if I would play it for them, because I had drumsticks in my hand when I walked into the room. I said, sure, and I played it. They were, I guess they were impressed. They handed me one of their cards and, asked me if I was interested in jamming with them. And I noticed the card had a lot of religious scripture on the back, and that was a big turnoff for me. I was not looking to, I definitely wasn't looking to be in a Christian band. I was not looking for God at all. I can't explain why. I didn't take their card. I left with the attitude, don't call me, I'll call you, thinking I was never going to call. And about a week later, I ended up calling him. I don't even know why.
Wow. So he's been referred to, that we've been told, at least in some accounts, that the members of that organization looked at him as the Messiah, the second Messiah. Others have just said he's a prophet. How did you view him? How did most of the people there view him?
Well, it took a while to figure out what Dave could do. And here's the best way I can explain it. The first time I went to Waco, and I got to know the group about 6 months living in California. First time I went to Waco, it was for a one of the religious festivals that are kept in the scripture. This community kept the scriptural festivals. People flown in from all over the world. And one of the earliest studies that I had there in front of with a big group is David had a Bible, and he put it up to his head, and he said, most people see this thing as two pieces of cow leather with a bunch of pages in between. He goes, I see it panoramically as if it's happening before me right now. And over the course of the next, and that was a pretty tall tale, I thought, but over the course of the next couple of weeks, of going through the studies and really getting into the seven seals and how they were broken down, how they found all the minor prophets, 12 major prophets, and in Revelation and in Genesis and just everywhere. You kind of came to the conclusion that he did see everything panoramically. And it was phenomenal. I mean, it was one of the best studies I've ever had in my life.
So he was not, as Dr. Tabor has said, he was not, in your opinion, an evil, crazy cult leader. That would be an inaccurate description of him. So
no, that's
if that's inaccurate, what is a good description for him?
This is his family. I mean, this is a community of people living, and it definitely wasn't like any other community I'd ever been in. But it was still a community of people all sharing the same burdens and learning the same things and trying to struggle with their own humanity.
Dr. Tabor.
Yeah, the word Messiah is what throws people off because it's Christ, right? David didn't claim to be Jesus Christ. He worshiped Jesus Christ. He was a Christian. But he did believe that the scriptures talk about a mysterious second Messiah, even called a sinful Messiah. And Gary will remember this. He would get on the phone with Henry and I think with Gary and a lot of them, and he would go on, right? He'd say, well, you got your Bible with you? Turn to Psalm 40. Who is that figure in Psalm 40? A man on a white horse. People think it's Jesus. But let's read on. What does it say in verse 17? His sins are more than the hairs of his head. Is that Jesus? So he was like a biblical kind of savant, in the sense that he would just chatter all of these scriptures, going to the Psalms and going here, and who is that bird from the east in Isaiah and so forth. And he had put all this together in his head. So actually the sinful Messiah, the second Messiah you might call it, is the opposite of Christ, but he also has to die, but he brings the final revelation that kind of ends all things. That's what he claimed to be, the final prophet.
So on February 28th,
the final messenger.
On February 28th, Gary, the ATF goes to the compound. What happens? Because we see this on television. I think we saw part of it, if not all of it, on TV that day. But they go there suspecting there's, an illegal cache of weapons? Is that correct?
Well, as I understand it, I wasn't.
You weren't there. I know.
There for the raid. I didn't get there until that night. But they had a search warrant for the premises and an arrest warrant for David Koresh.
Based on what? Based on what?
Pardon?
Based on what?
I'm trying to get there. Based on the fact that I guess they had an undercover agent that had given them information and they had other investigative results. I don't know. I'm not defending or rationalizing what they did and why they did it, but that was the rationale. They had the search warrant and the arrest warrant, and a news truck was looking for the compound. Word had gotten out that there was going to be a raid, and a local rural mailman stopped to give them directions. That turned out to be Koresh's brother-in-law. He went back to Mount Carmel and told them they were coming. And so when ATF arrived, there's controversy who shot first. Was it the ATF or was it the Branch Davidians?
How did they announce themselves? Did they knock on the front door? Did they just use a bullhorn and call from across the front yard? How did they announce to the people inside?
They tried to disguise their entry by using two pickup trucks pulling large cattle trailers. They're kind of covered trailers that people move cattle around. And all the agents who were going to move to various assignments in terms of entering the building were inside those two trailers. And as they pulled up and started to get out, Koresh reportedly came out in the front steps. ATF says he was armed, and he says he wasn't. I don't know. But a shootout ensued one way or another.
Yeah.
Led to the tragic circumstances that have been pretty well reported in terms of that two-hour shootout with significant loss of life.
One of the pieces of this story, Dr. Tabor, that you say is often overlooked is the fact that David Koresh allegedly went to the front door of the compound the day the government decided to go in, saying, "Don't shoot, there are women and children in here." At what point did they start firing?
I think the film... people are watching the Paramount film, mm-hmm. It portrays it pretty accurately from what I've been able to tell of interviewing everybody. And, of course, David Thibodeau was there, although he wasn't at the front door. But that essentially they didn't want the raid. They're not looking for an apocalypse. So he said, don't shoot. There's women and children here. And there are dogs in the front, a little compound of little, some puppies and other dogs. Part of the plan was to shoot the dogs, which they did. So one theory is that they shot the dogs. But if you look at how the trucks drove up to the front, you know, very fast, these two cattle car trucks full of 76 heavily armed people, and they cut streaming out immediately and taking their stations. David at the front, it's very frightening. And then, of course, he shuts the door. He shot through the door. And Perry Jones is standing there. He's shot in the stomach and later dies. From then on, there's this shootout for several hours. What's interesting, though, and I'm not saying the Davidians didn't fire. They obviously did. There were four ATF agents killed. But if you've seen all the video, everybody's seen this. There are ATF agents in the front crouching behind the trucks and the cars that the Davidians owned. Those windshields are not broken. Mm. And they're firing whole magazines into this frame building. One of the Davidians, if we're going to call him that, Winston, was just getting out of bed, and he shot as he's sitting on the side of his bed eating a piece of toast. Mm. People were terrified on the floor. They called 911 within minutes and said, call it off, call it off. So I think inside, they were not wanting or looking for this, but they had to account for it in terms of their biblical faith.
Couple of questions, David. I mean, first of all, what's it like to be inside a building that's being shot at by all these armed law enforcement people, number one? And number two, did any of you ever think that something like this would ever happen?
Yeah, well, number one is it was absolutely terrifying, obviously. That's the last thing that I was looking for coming to Mount Carmel. Did I ever think that something like this? I kind of did think something like this would happen because all of the scripture that they've talked about, it ended with government agents coming in and attacking this message, no matter how you want to slice it. The ATF, that raid was so violent. They used helicopters. They had the cattle trailers. It was so unnecessary, and so it showed to us the arrogance of man and the hubris of the federal government. Mm. I did want to say one more thing about when you said who fired, when we were talking about the discussion of who fired first. To me, it's the lack of evidence that really kind of shows who fired first, and there are two things. We know that the ATF was taping from the surveillance house across the street. When they were asked for that tape, that would have showed David at the front door. It could have showed who fired first. That tape disappeared. They said it didn't exist. That it disappeared in the melee somehow. The second thing is after April 19th, when the place burned to the ground, there were two steel doors at the front of the building. One steel door is entered into evidence. The other door has disappeared. That's the door that David held in his hand, and the one the attorneys who came in during the siege, Dick DeGaren and Jack Zimmerman, saw the evidence of the majority of the bullet holes coming from the outside of the building in. Mm. And also we know that Perry Jones was shot at that front door. So when David shut the front door, Perry Jones, 70-year-old man, went down from a gunshot wound to his abdomen coming in through that door. So to me, it's the lack of evidence that really shows who fired first.
There was a stash of guns. I don't know how many guns, but they were automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons that had been converted to automatic weapons. You're saying that's not true?
I'm saying that's what the FBI has said. I have never seen those weapons, and I've never fired a fully automatic weapon, so I don't know. I have fired some semi-automatic weapons.
The crime scene, clearly shows that over 100 weapons were found and a million rounds of ammunition. So let's be accurate on that. And the only thing I would help you with, David, on the front door situation, clearly shots came into the front door. But, I mean, from an investigator's point of view, that doesn't prove anything about who fired first. Someone potentially, and I'm not saying they did, but potentially somebody could have fired first out of a window. People get panicked in these kinds of situations, and once a gunfight starts, all hell breaks loose.
Right.
So I think it's a tragedy. However it started, I'm not defending anything that the ATF did, but I think we have to be careful here not to suggest that these agents decided to drive up and start just shooting everybody they could. That's just irresponsible and not accurate.
So
Let me say something on the guns, too.
Whenever it starts disappearing is when people start really doubting their government theory. I mean, that's just it's a fact.
Let me be clear about something here. You, David, lived in the compound. How long were you there?
I was there a couple of years.
Okay, and you say that you never saw these weapons, never.
No, we had firearms. They went to gun shows all the time. I fired on them. We had people from the community of Waco come and shoot at our firing range with us.
Okay.
We were playing in a band in Waco for a while at a place called Q-Sticks. I remember one drummer from one of the other bands would come out with his girlfriend. We'd all shoot on the firing range.
There
were guns. They went to gun shows every weekend.
Was this purely recreational, Dr.?
No, I think it's a business. Think of how many guns does a gun shop have.
Right.
They're going to gun shows. They're making some of their living by
buying and selling
guns. And I think they, like many Texans, they were intrigued with guns. Someone made the point that the per capita gun ownership in Texas is actually more than the Branch Davidians. There's 123 Branch Davidians. Mm-hmm. Let's take the children out, 80 adults, and they have 100 guns. That's actually, the average Texan has 3 guns, presumably. So it's a culture. We know about the gun culture in our culture. My understanding is that, I mean, I certainly would not defend this or have any interest in it, but that you can convert an AK-47 to fully automatic if you fill out certain paperwork that they had neglected to turn in.
So
I hope this isn't over paperwork, you know.
That's not the case.
Is that not the case? You're not allowed to do that then?
Texas might have been okay with that, but that was not consistent with federal law.
Okay. So is there any dispute about how many guns that were in the compound owned by the people who lived there and what their purpose there was? In other words, were they strictly buying and selling to make money or having some recreational shooting, or was it because they felt at some point in time they would need these weapons to defend themselves?
Definitely the latter.
Definitely the latter.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's all of them. I think it's all those points.
Yeah.
And why did David Koresh feel that he would have to defend himself? You're living there peacefully. You're preaching the gospel. He's developing his Seven Seals paper. Mm-hmm. Why did he? There are children there. Why did he feel he'd have to defend himself?
You know, he saw things differently. I remember just about 4 to 6 months, somewhere in the 4 to 6 months range before the ATF attacked, I was on a roof with David, and we were working on a putting shillings down. Anyway, he was saying...
Well, let's hold that thought, because I have to take a break. We'll come back to that in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the ATF raid and the 51-day siege that followed in February of 1993 of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. We have one of the survivors of that raid who was inside the compound. David Thibodeau is with us, author of Waco, A Survivor Story. Gary Nessner is a former chief of the FBI's Crisis Negotiating Unit. He was on the scene for 26 of the 51 days trying to negotiate this. He's the author of My Life, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. And together, their two books form the basis of a Paramount miniseries, which is on television even as we speak. And Dr. James Tabor's with us, from Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte, author of Why Waco. So ultimately, Gary, you were the FBI's chief negotiator on the scene at first. How does that work? What are you trying to negotiate? We have people who are wounded inside the compound because of an attack because of an exchange of gunfire between them and the ATF. What are you trying to achieve there? How do you work with people in that kind of a tense situation?
Yeah, when I show up, and I flew out that night from the East Coast, and you can't imagine a worse situation to begin with. You've had four dead ATF agents, 17 to 20 wounded. I've heard different numbers, and I think 6 Davidians killed and quite a few wounded, including Koresh himself. And all of a sudden you show up and say, hey, you know, let's be friends and, let's work this out amicably. I mean, it takes a long time to do that.
it wasn't a hostage situation or a bargaining situation. There's no substantive demand that David Koresh had. The only demand, as it were, was go away and leave us alone. And sadly, that was the one exact thing we could not do. So the job of my negotiation team and I was about as challenging as negotiation jobs get in trying to create a relationship of trust and cooperation to get people out. And we had some success the first half. And, there was internal issues with the FBI that tended to harm that later on.
On the day before the fire, April 18th, 1993, David Koresh called, I'm told, FBI negotiators, and in a tape supplied by Dr. Tabor, Koresh sounds pretty level and very measured, but also suspicious, as though he's put two and two together and believes the government's motives aren't exactly pure.
We have done everything we can to be able to communicate in a nice, passionate way. We've, told you what our work with God is, and we've been kind. We've not been your everyday kind of cult. We've not been your everyday kind of terrorist, which I'm sure you're familiar with having to deal with. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things that the FBI or these generals are doing is just kind of way beyond the scope of reason. And they're not only destroying private property, they're also removing evidences. And this doesn't seem like that these are moves that should be made by a government who says to a people that we're going to be able to take this up in a court of law.
This is a very short clip from a very long, last conversation with Koresh prior to the fire. What else transpired during that conversation, if you remember, Gary? Did he have a reason to be suspicious?
I wasn't there at the time, but what I believe he's referring to, and Dr. Tabor may have a better sense of that from his examination of this, or even David, but the FBI had already at that point in time come to the conclusion, rightly or wrongly, that David really was not going to prepare the seven seals as he had promised to his attorneys to come out. Steve Snyder had been asked, have you seen anything? And he basically said on the phone, well, I haven't seen anything, and I'm the one that's going to edit it. And so the FBI came to the conclusion that this was just a stalling technique. So they begin to clear away some vehicles and other items from around the compound in order, I guess, to facilitate the entry of the gas. And I think that is the behavior and action that Koresh was referring to. I don't buy that, even though I wasn't there at the time, the FBI was trying to destroy evidence. I think they were just trying to use brute force to sort of encourage the Davidians to come out.
Well, talk to me about the force that precipitated all this. This was the largest gun battle, I think, between law enforcement and the people they were going after in the history of the country, and the biggest battle of its kind since the Civil War. That seems to be a big show of force. Was that show of force necessary?
Well, if you're asking me, I wouldn't have planned it that way. Years later, 3 years later, we worked the Freeman situation in Montana, an anti-government right-wing group, and we arrested the leader and his number one man away from the others, which is exactly what I would have recommended they do with David Koresh, who reportedly was, out and about from time to time and could have been arrested away from the compound. I think that would have changed everything. They chose not to do it that way, and, I'll let somebody from ATF, discuss that.
And the FBI pulled you off of this. You were there for 26 of the 51 days, and they pulled you off. Were you getting pressure from Washington? Because this drug out on TV for 51 days. Were you getting pressure from Washington to move this thing along, to speed this thing up?
Not from Washington. A lot of people want to blame Washington. As far as I can tell, Washington, talking about the larger government, the White House and so forth, were pretty much disengaged on this. But the local command of the FBI at Waco was under a lot of pressure. This was costing, a couple $100,000 a day. And the FBI is a proud organization. We were, subject to the criticism in the media for everyone that later criticized the FBI for it, for the putting in the tear gas and the ultimate outcome. The same people or more were saying, what's taking so long? Why can't you enforce the law?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of pressure, but the difference between negotiators and commanders and tactical people is, as negotiators, we're pretty much accustomed to disappointment and having people not do what they say they were going to do, like David Koresh's earlier promise to surrender. We don't overreact to that when we're disappointed and we get back on the negotiation strategy. Others, however, can sometimes take that personally and then manifest their anger and frustration in ways that ultimately are counterproductive to the negotiations. I think that's the real story here.
David Koresh sent out a number of, I think, all the children except for his own prior to that fire, if that is correct. And he sent out adults who he felt couldn't make it through the standoff. How many people were left, David, in the compound prior to the fire?
That question was for me?
Yes.
I mean, there was, you know, I was the hardcore group of people. I mean, there was still quite a few children. There was
74,
still,
I think.
Yeah. So how many did he send out?
35.
I think 30, when I was there, 35 people.
35, yeah.
Including 21 children.
And did you choose personally not to leave because it wasn't an option for you, or because you felt if I walk out that front door I might get shot, or if I walk out that front door they're going to put me in jail? What was your motivation for staying?
First of all, I chose personally not to leave. I mean, I was going to go through this at any cost to me. I had to see this through to the end. I knew that early on.
Why?
I did feel that I was going to be shot. The only reason I exited the building is during the fire. Was because I was about to burn. The wall next to my head had caught fire and it singed my hair, and then could hear it crackling. And I just said, okay, I'd rather be shot than burned to death. That was my attitude. So when I went out the door, and I wasn't shot, I was quite surprised. I was, you know, happily surprised. I turned around to see Clive come out. He was patting his arms out because they were on fire. And this is something that people don't really understand. I think they may understand it from watching the show that's on Paramount Network now. But over the course of the 51 days, because of a lot of the problems the FBI were having internally, as Gary can attest to and talk about, it made the negotiators would tell us one thing. The tactical commanders would come and do something totally different. And it just undercut everything. I mean, I was in the process of telling a story before we went to commercial.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
David and I were on a roof, and we saw, you know, the road. And David goes, "What are you going to do 6 months from now when there's tanks up there?" And I said, "Dave, the government's never going to bring tanks onto this property." And 6 months later, I'm watching tanks go up and down the Double E Ranch Road. That's something that I think it's the militarization of law enforcement in this case should have been so shocking to the country. And it was to a certain segment of the country, I think. That just shouldn't happen. You don't need to go attacking your citizens when they're willing to talk to you. That's, to me, the biggest problem of this whole thing. This definitely could have been avoided. David Koresh was reasonable. You could have talked to him. They didn't want that. They wanted a dynamic entry-style raid, so they would look good in Congress. And then be able to get their budget.
Dr. Tabor, you and Phil Arnold were trying to negotiate to get the Seven Seals document that David Koresh was going to put together. That the deal evidently was, give me time to assemble my philosophy so it's presentable to the public, and then I'll come out.
What we realize, what a prophet wants is to speak to the world. That's what the book of Revelation says. If David's who he is, he's supposed to speak to the entire world. Mm-hmm. He had 100 followers. He's not reaching the world. So what we proposed to him is that if he would write his message, as Paul wrote epistles in prison, right? Be like the Apostle Paul. Then we would take it to the world. We would take it to the American Academy of Religion and other organizations. David naively thought that everybody from Billy Graham to the Pope would be rocked back on their heels and say, oh, well, finally, we've got the truth of the Bible. I don't think that would have happened, but he believed that. And so after Passover, on April 14th, he sent out his final letter. It's the last we have from him. And he had worked it out with the lawyers, the legal side of the exit, and with us, I guess you'd call the theological side, and that is that he would start working on this manuscript. He did finish the first seal. I know some FBI agents, Jeff Jamar and others, have doubted that, but, you know, we've got a copy of it. I've talked to Ruth Riddle, the typist who typed it all night the night before the fire.
Okay.
It came out on a disc. I got the disc from Dick DeGaren. The FBI turned it over to him. And this is, I'm holding it up here, this is a copy. It's available online. So now, to most people, it's pretty obtuse. But it's his theology, his view. And he says, if I complete this and give it to Tabor and Arnold, I'll come out.
So on April 19th, that's when the fire started at the compound. There's just as there are questions about who fired the first shot in February, there are questions about who started the fire. Those of us watching it on television, we saw these tanks come up and push their the gun barrel.
Booms.
Into
gun barrels. Those are booms.
Okay, right? Booms into the side of the house, breaking through the walls of the house. And some people have said, well, they started the fire that way. Other people say that David Koresh perhaps rigged the place or started the fire on his own. What do you think happened, Gary? Because you were there watching it. They called you in to watch this, and
well,
you weren't even part of the operation anymore.
I watched it from FBI headquarters, and I was told I would either be going back to Waco or I would be going the next day to a prison riot hostage situation in Lucasville, Ohio, which I ended up going to on February 20th. But, the only thing I can go on is the Danforth Commission. You know, there were several reports in the immediate aftermath of Waco, and they concluded the Davidians started the fire. Those were not believed by a lot of people. They were thought to be self-serving by the government. So this question lingered for many, many years. And in 2000, the Danforth Commission, run by former Senator Danforth from Missouri, did an exhaustive and the most detailed investigation. Three independent fire inspectors, the infrared viewing showing the fire starting in three places, the FBI microphone tapes from inside that the Davidians said spread the fuel, light the fires. Graham Craddock, one of the survivors, came out and said he saw people lighting fires. I don't think there's any question. It remains controversial for some. And I know my friend David Thibodeau and I disagree on this, but to me, there's no question about who started the fire.
And you're saying the Davidians started the fire?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I see there's a lot of questions. Yeah, I think it's still up for debate, to tell you the truth. If you see the infrared video that Gary was talking about, but you watch it for yourself, there are several indications of fully automatic weapons fire at the tanks firing at the back of the building. Now, the back of the building is where the women and children were. And the FBI has said on many, many different occasions, how come no adults came out of that building with kids? Well, if they're at the back of the building and they're being shot at, it would be kind of hard to come out with children if you're being shot at. We also have flashbang grenades in areas of the building that you can see on the infrared where the fires were believed to have begun. And also pyrotechnic devices found in those areas. So I think there's a lot of debate.
Didn't you have oil lanterns for light? There's no electricity sitting on bales of hay. Is it possible? You know, maybe there are several causes.
Right.
I just wonder.
There were lanterns in every room.
We have a minute left. So, Gary, I want to talk to you just really briefly.
They have actually.
Hold it. I have a minute left, and I want to talk, Gary, about these militias and these cults that seem to be all over the place. We heard about them all the time in the 80s and 90s, and law enforcement was very concerned with them. What happened to all those organizations?
Well, the big thing is, you know, Oklahoma City bombing. Timothy McVeigh had come out to Waco, and part of his stated motivation for blowing up the Murrah building was what had happened in Waco. And but when that happened, I would say that the militia movement was really growing pretty significantly. But that was a damper, I believe. Others may disagree, but it seemed like when all the children were killed in the Murrah Federal Building, a lot of the sort of come lately right-wing folks said, wait a minute, that's not what I signed up for.
Right.
So we began in the FBI a real significant outreach with the right-wing movement. We saw a drop in their membership and a drop in the confrontations we had with them.
And let me stop you there because I'm out of time. Gary Nesner is with the FBI. David Thibodeau was a Branch Davidian. The two have books. Both are the basis of the TV show Waco on the Paramount Network. And Dr. James Tabor, Professor of Religious Studies at UNC Charlotte, also with us. Thank you all for the hour.